When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Hello, Zero Books readers and viewers. I'm Douglas Lane again on the live stream. I'm here with Chris Catrone. It is March 10th, Tuesday, which is going to be a big day for the Democratic primaries, one way or another. It doesn't look good for my boy Bernie, and I thought it would be a good time to bring on Chris to give so that he could give me a critique of this embrace of social democratic politics and this backwards embrace of the Democratic Party. Chris Catrone is a college educator, writer, and media artist committed to critical thinking and artistic practice and the politics of social emancipation. He is the former head of the often contrarian Marxist group, the Platypus Affiliated Society, and I'm glad to have him here today. Hey, Chris, thanks for coming on to the live stream.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
So, you have been, for the last 4 years, a very controversial figure on the left, or at least for those who are following you. I think that the Platypus Affiliated Society has a history which is controversial. You've been a contrarian group, or a group that's sort of critiquing the left from the left. And this is a moment where I thought your voice might be useful, if not correct, but at least useful, to bring in, because it looks as though all the energy that's been spent on the social democratic side of the left since Trump was elected is about to be diminished or destroyed or shown up, or that we are, that the at the very least Bernie Sanders is looking very his chances of getting the nomination aren't looking good. And I just thought I'd bring you in to discuss that issue, or that moment, and also your take, which you elaborated in a essay called "Why Not Trump" a while back. But before I do that, I want to clarify just what your position is on Trump, because when people follow you on Facebook, sometimes you'll say things very briefly that sound like Republican talking points. And I was on Sky News the other day and was asked, it was kind of a funny segment at a bar. And I was asked, you know, about the coronavirus. And I was there with a member of the GOP in Oregon. And he gave the talking point, which is, oh, it's a very serious thing, but the Democrats are politicizing it, and that's a hoax. And it's, you know, we shouldn't be afraid, and Trump is doing a fine job, something along those lines. And, you know, this critique, this criticism of Trump is unwarranted. It was basically his perspective. And in the process, he sort of downplayed the threat from the coronavirus, I thought. And then you posted something similar recently. So I wanted to know what your take was on the criticism of Trump around the coronavirus and the coronavirus itself, maybe.
Okay, so I would say, just, you know, to begin with, I don't have much to say about this, but I would say that obviously the coronavirus is a serious issue, and you know, it's a health emergency at a global level. We'll see the extent of the epidemic or pandemic. At the same time, it does have to be acknowledged that the mainstream media is very anti-Trump, and they just use anything that they can against him. So, you know, I think that if there were an actual political position, in other words, if I were a member of an actual mass socialist party, then of course one would be in a position to criticize the government in its handling of any issue, and to show up, you know, the mendacity of it. Unfortunately, the only opposition to Trump that really exists is the Democratic Party. And I consider the Democratic Party to be at least as much an obstacle and an opponent politically as the Republicans and Trump.
Yeah, well, I feel as though even if we don't have a social movement behind us or a real socialist party, that as individuals, maybe we should try to step back from the media circus and not only rely on the Democratic Party to frame the issue and be critical ourselves. So
as civil social, individuals, in other words, if I was a participant in a, healthcare organization, for example, of course, right, one would have to be on the government criticizing their every move. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I feel like as a kind of a, YouTube expert, pundit, whatever the heck I am, publisher, writer, that to the degree that I have a voice, I should be critical of the government as well, especially right now. And I'll tell you just a little personal story. It's not much, but my kid, Simon, he's 17 and he's a foreign exchange student in South Korea.
Oh, wow.
And so he has been, kind of locked in his host family's house under quarantine, not because of the South Korean government, but because of the Rotary Club, which sent him. So they're being extra.
Demanding that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it has been a debate for about 3 weeks as to if he'll be coming back early, just what the threat has level is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's not coming back, and the reason why is because they decided it was safer for him to stay there in his host family house, his host family's house, than it is to get on a plane and fly internationally back to the United States. That he'll
probably
be,
true.
Yeah. So I feel
infected.
Well, right. But the nice thing about South Korea is that they've been very good at getting a program going for testing, and they've actually been the fastest state to respond to the virus and to really do mass testing. Mm-hmm. And I feel as though in the United States, we are not at all prepared for a variety of reasons to really get that effort going.
Right. So I'd say, my following this in terms of the Trump administration rhetoric, because I guess there's a difference between the administration and Trump himself,
right?
That can be observed, but clearly they've been walking a line between trying to meet the emergency and also to prevent a run on the limited testing capacities that they have. In other words, they don't want people who shouldn't be tested to be tested because it's a drain on resources.
Right. The same thing's going on on the level of something simple like surgical masks,
exactly.
Yeah, they are kind of putting out this rumor that it doesn't work, you don't need one. But the truth is they want to prioritize those masks to go into the healthcare system.
And
So, yeah, I mean, it's a very, it's a scary moment, actually. It's unclear just how bad this is going to be, whether it will be on the level of the Spanish flu or on the level of SARS. I think maybe already past the level of SARS, but in any case,
I was recalling myself the H1N1,
the swine flu
right under Obama and what that looked like in terms of a response. They're not entirely analogous in terms of the threat level. But I do recall, them mobilizing for the subsequent flu season. You know, they were able to get it to roll out a vaccination program. I do think that, the health emergency might be a bigger threat. But I'm also aware of the fact that we're in an election year. And in the election year, when all else fails, blame an epidemic.
Right. Well, we'll come back to coronavirus maybe in this conversation, but let's push ahead because I wanted to talk to you about.
And by the way, I don't think it will work either. In other words, I don't think it will really affect Trump's reelection.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up later. So we'll just stay with it now. I feel as though any government that would be at the helm during a true catastrophe, a truly catastrophic outbreak, would face the likelihood of being thrown out. regardless of the merit of the charge of incompetence.
Regardless of the alternative.
And regardless of the alternative, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that I didn't think Biden had any chance of beating Trump mm-hmm. until recently. And I thought, if with the economy tanking and with this coronavirus, if people are truly feeling like they're suffering and truly are suffering in November, all bets are off. I mean, this, I don't think it.
Yeah. If they feel like it's Trump's fault.
Well, yeah.
I don't think it will affect his base.
Right.
It will not affect his base. And he's in a pretty strong position. The Senate elections in 2018 in the midterm show the Electoral College map for him to regain office.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. Why not Trump again? You gave a lecture and you read that essay and the Why I Wish Hillary Clinton Had Won essay a little while back. Why I Wish Hillary Clinton Had Won essay came out of the Left Forum conference, where the MHI, an organization I'm familiar with,
Marxist Humanist Initiative,
yeah, put you on kind of on a little show trial, to charge you with being a Trumpist or a left collaborationist or something.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel like I'm in a position to judge whether or not behind closed doors you're meeting with the Trump's people or not, but I doubt it. I tend to doubt that.
Closest that we've come to that is that Tucker Carlson reads my stuff. And right. So there's been some talk behind the scenes of whether he'll have me on his show. But he and his staff have read my articles. And, there is this kind of funny right-wing kind of flirtation with Marxism that's going on. Mm. Is it the guy Michael Lind, right?
Who's
kind of American conservative, American Affairs Journal has published some leftists like Nancy Fraser and Angela Nagel and others.
Mm-hmm.
There has been this right-wing flirtation with Marxism ever since Trump's election, where they kind of feel like maybe the Marxists are onto something and talking about class and capitalism and et cetera. And so I do think I've my own writings have kind of evidently fallen within that purview.
Mm-hmm.
The right, of course they feel much more free to entertain the full range of ideas. And that has to do with the nature of the right itself, that they're less driven by ideas, they're more opportunist. And so the left, it's not that I would say that the left ought to entertain right-wing ideas, they should not. However, the left is much more dogmatic than the right is. In other words, the left, we shouldn't confuse principled with dogmatic. And I think the left likes to think of itself as principled, but is actually rather dogmatic.
Yeah, I would say that the flirtation with Marxism and leftist ideas on the right, there's a range probably of motivations behind that, but it has been stated in public by people on the far right, on the alt-right, Richard Spencer, that they are strategically going to move to the left and talk in terms of class as a part of their agenda to attract working class white people into their movement.
He also infamously said that being around white identity politics people, he felt like they were one step away from his perspective, that they could be converted easily into white nationalism. And that's probably true. In other words, a lot of white people who are PC identity politics types are really, at least at a psychological level, expressing their own racism.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably true as well. And that's something to talk about in terms of this electoral contest, because the politics of race that have and the kind of wokeness that's infused itself into the Democratic primaries is sort of stunning. Maybe the difference is not how much of it there is, but how aware of it I am. But it seems to me that the sort of naked opportunism around race is on full display. Race and gender and identity politics in general.
Yeah, I would say the black constituency politics of the Democratic Party has revealed its essentially conservative character.
Right. I mean, yeah, when Bernie lost South Carolina and he said, the establishment is, you know, arrayed against me, coordinated against me. And that's, we knew that was going to happen. We'll always have to fight both the Democratic establishment, the mm-hmm. Republican establishment, and the billionaire establishment. And the response was, how dare you call these black voters in South Carolina the establishment?
Well, it's not the voters so much as it's the turnout machine. It's the churches and it's the black Democrat politicians and their machines. They exist. I mean, there is such a thing. I'm pretty sure Bobby Rush here, the ex Black Panther, has endorsed Biden in Chicago.
That just is stunning to me that he.
It's not. I mean, Adolf Reed has analyzed this for many years, going back to the late 70s and into the 80s. The Democratic Party has always been an ethnic minority constituency party. That's their basis, the degree to which they weren't based in the slavocracy. They were based in the northern immigrant urban constituencies, Catholics,
mm-hmm.
right? And they just expanded. In other words, as a function of the civil rights movement, they expanded that to include blacks who had been a Republican constituency. Also, when the Republican Party was the liberal party and the Democrats were the conservative party. And since the 60s, they've also included other groups as if they were ethno-cultural constituencies like women and gays,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously, you know, a stretch because women are not like an ethnic group,
although
feminists would have you believe that they are,
mm-hmm.
right? Neither are gays, although, Bernie in the 2016 primaries, he called the National Organization of Women, Planned Parenthood, and the Human Rights Campaign the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right about that.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, and that's been clarified in this cycle as they've come out against him.
Yeah.
So my question here around your Why Not Trump Again essay and the comments you made afterwards a while back is this. Why were you so convinced that Bernie would not be allowed to get the nomination? And I think that's a particularly interesting way of putting it. Not that he couldn't get the popular support, but that he would not be allowed to get the nomination. And then also, why were you so convinced that even if he did, he couldn't win the presidency? I guess those are very different kinds of questions.
Very different questions. So the way that I put it, you know, I kind of hedged my bets there. I said they wouldn't let him be the nominee,
mm-hmm.
What struck me is that he's kind of plateaued. He's performing the same way this time around as in 2016. In mm-hmm. other words, the limits of his support are manifest. And the argument in 2016 against Bernie by the Democratic Party establishment was very similar to the argument of the Republican Party establishment against Trump, which is that they were winning in the primaries largely on the basis, not exclusively, of course, but largely on the basis of independent voters
mm-hmm.
participating in the primaries. And therefore, there was something illegitimate. And I think I read recently that some Democratic Party person said, remember that we're not just choosing a presidential candidate and nominee, we're choosing the leader of our party.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so from the Democratic Party perspective, they allow independent voters to participate, but only insofar as they're kind of test marketing candidates. But really, it is meant to be the party choosing its leader. I think even Amber Frost had an article in Jacobin about the presidential system and the peculiarities of the presidential and party system in the United States, where the president is also the leader of the party.
Right.
Right. That they kind of mix a popular election with an internal party selection process.
Mm-hmm.
So I hedged my bets because I wasn't sure that Bernie wasn't going to do better. It turns out he has kind of reached a certain ceiling of support in the primary votes. And so the other, you know, the centrist, moderate, right wing candidates were basically getting Hillary's vote, but just divided among themselves.
Right.
That's turning out to be kind of the case, but I wasn't sure. I thought that he might do better this time, actually. I thought that Bernie might do significantly better than in 2016 this time around. Turns out not so much. And so I hedged my bets back in December of last year, December 2019. I said they won't let him because I thought, you know, the superdelegates, right? I thought that second round convention voting, brokered convention, if they, you know, because I didn't think he would get the majority of primary delegates. And so given that fact, I thought, well, then for sure he's not going to get it through a brokered convention.
Yeah, there's all sorts of armchair quarterbacking going on right now amongst the punditry who are supporting Bernie Sanders to ask, you know, what created this ceiling for him. And I feel as though there were a number of factors, one of which was the way in which the major media were allied.
I mean, they really slam him constantly. I mean, it's a constant attack on Bernie, and that was true in 2016, and it's worse now.
He was not able to get momentum out of the wins that he got in the early primary states because of the major media and because of the Democratic Party and the DNC. So like in Iowa, for instance, he won Iowa, but that win was delayed and tampered with, and the media spin around it was never solidified. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the other states, when he was winning, the kind of story was, oh no, what will this mean? Trump will get reelected, was like sort of the mainstream cable news approach. And I think a lot of younger people and people who are involved with Bernie Sanders thought TV is fading. No one watches TV anymore. We don't have to worry about the cable news people. We have our own media apparatus. And that was wrongheaded, I guess.
It is, because the cable news, they have a very strong online presence.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's not TV, you know, it's their broad spectrum.
Yeah,
dominance,
right.
You know, to use a military term, the broad spectrum dominance over right. public discourse.
But I also feel like you're right about the machines. You know, you hear the term the machine or the Democratic machine in this state or that state. What is the machine? Is it just a system of institutions like churches or other civic institutions that coordinate and organize voters? Or
it's a turnout machine. That's real. And that's more true in the November general election than it is in the primaries. Because in the primaries, of course, the candidates themselves have to show that they're capable of enhancing the existing machine. Right. Mm-hmm. They have to do their own turnout. And again, I think Bernie's primary election organization is stronger this time than last time, and yet is still maxing out in terms of the voters that they're getting. In other words, they're not getting significantly higher turnout. And when they are getting significantly higher turnout, it's in the primaries, it's in Biden's favor, which means that the established machine is ramping up to you know, keep Bernie from winning the nomination. And that's, you know, to be expected. Now, the Democrats, you know, they have their NGOs, the associated NGOs, so labor unions. Mm-hmm. So labor unions, like, will endorse candidates. And then the members may or may not vote for the candidate that's
right.
endorsed.
Like the Culinary Union in Nevada.
Yes. So, however, the unions also have a turnout machine, which is not identical with their members. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine, for example, worked as staff at SEIU here in Chicago. And then she was, back in 2008, she was involved in the turnout machine for voting in November for Obama. And she was sent with a team to Gary, Indiana. And they, you know, transported people from their homes to the polling places, took them to McDonald's for lunch. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. and that's not the union. That's not the union membership. That's the community.
Right.
Right. But the unions are providing the staff and the resources, you know, the vehicles to transport people to polling places. Now, the Republicans have that, too, in the form of the evangelicals. right? So they have a church. Otherwise, you know, they don't have much of that, the Republicans. The Democrats have a lot of that, though, because they have various NGO organizations that do this stuff.
Earlier, you said that the Democratic Party ran as a kind of a party of ethnic coalitions.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican Party represents, it doesn't run that way. It's not a collection of ethnic coalitions, but something else. Is that right?
It's much more Chamber of Commerce. In other words, their version of NGO is, of course, you know, the capitalist corporate and small business, you know, medium-sized business, I should say. You know, like not mom-and-pop outfits and not mega corporations, because the mega corporations are a lot of them. Democratic Party NGOs. We can call them NGOs. For political purposes, they're NGOs, just like any other NGO. They're for-profit as opposed to non-profit, but they're still non-governmental organizations. And, you know, they encourage their employees to vote, and they do tell their employees who their preferred candidate is. So my husband, my partner, works for a major corporation, and they endorse Democrats. You know, they tell their employees, you know, vote, participate, vote for whoever you want, but our choice is.
It
works. I mean, it's effective. And the Republicans have that, of course. But less so, more at the kind of medium and certain business sectors, of course.
Okay. And so, and they're representing then just the business interests in the country, as opposed to all these different civil society interests.
Community organizations, the so-called community organization, which is, of course, you know, very much a neoliberal term of art.
Right. Okay, so now the question I have at this point is, why is the Democratic Party so allergic to allowing a social democrat like Bernie Sanders to be its party leader? To be the party leader, why is so much energy being spent to stop Sanders when he could probably give a lot of legitimacy to the Democratic Party? They seem to be wasting their legitimacy, especially with young people, which will be, you know, in short order. And it seems like, you know, these people are going to live forever, but they won't.
Mm-hmm.
Will be the future of the party.
Mm-hmm.
When from our way of thinking, the Social Democratic Project won't fundamentally change society. It's not going to really wrestle the power out of their hands or fundamentally restructure society.
Right.
So it might just alleviate some problems in the short term.
They could use Bernie.
Yeah.
Why not? Right. But they don't want to, and they don't feel like they need to.
Right.
So certainly they could use Bernie. Now, okay. Let's just pinch ourselves for a moment here.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie doesn't expect to win.
Right.
He never did. Not now, not in 2016. He's running a message candidacy, a protest candidacy. He didn't expect to win the nomination, let alone the presidency. So the argument, because you'll hear this from him, he will say, you know, we're building a movement. And, you know, he will make it clear that what he wants is for the Democrats to be more progressive and that that's what his candidacy is about. That was true in 2016, and that's true now. He doesn't expect to win the nomination. He never expected to win the nomination, let alone the presidency, because you have to win the nomination to win the presidency.
Yeah.
Okay. He was never going to run independently as a third party candidate. That was never going to happen. He wasn't trying to split the Democratic Party or spoil them or, you know, ruin their chances, which is very different. The Greens, for example, do want to do that. They want to punish the Democrats for not being progressive.
Right.
So they are spoilers, and they are interested in spoiling, and they are interested in punishing and giving negative lessons to the Democrats to try to push them to the left. Bernie was never trying to do that. And so then what is it about? It's about showing the Democratic Party the untapped potential of a more progressive agenda. Right?
Right.
It's showing, you know, look, there is this constituency, there is this support for this. So that's one thing. The other thing is that as the millennials age And as the post-colonials age, they're going to look less like AOC and more like Pete Buttigieg in terms of their actual positions on things.
Mm-hmm.
And no, AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley do not represent a growing faction in the congressional representation or local representation of the Democratic Party. They're not going to be primarying people in the Midwest or other kinds of states and replacing them with progressives. That's not going to happen.
Why not?
Because the constituency doesn't exist for that.
Because the millennials are not either as broken up into different ethnic categories. I guess that's how they would be broken up. Yeah. They're not going to support that social democratic turn.
They're not. No. So I was reading this, for instance, also the, you know, if you looked at the primaries, you might have had this idea that between Warren and Bernie, there was like a larger progressive constituency than there actually was.
Mm-hmm.
Warren's voters are going to go mostly for Biden, and Warren herself will probably end up endorsing Biden. Probably yeah. not right away.
I really was so upset. So many people were so upset when Warren dropped out and didn't endorse Bernie. And
she wasn't going to do that. She already made the sexist accusation against Bernie. She's not going there. She's not, right?
Right.
She's not for Bernie. And she's not for encouraging his supporters either.
From your perspective, that accusation against...
That killed her.
That did.
People don't like that. And
right.
They don't like the fact that she does, in fact, lie.
Right.
About all sorts of things.
But you would say maybe that accusation was not only about like her own personal politics or her own personal psychology. It was about saying, I am on the side of this fractured neoliberal coalition politics of ethnic identity and not for something more universal.
She was trying to get women's votes that way.
Oh,
that's
what
that
was
trying to do.
You would think
it
she would have.
It was foolish, but that's what the pitch was.
I mean, there's a small sliver of women who respond to that. There's no doubt about that.
Not a small sliver. Like in terms of the Democratic Party, a significant number.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, of course, that doesn't appeal at all to a lot of women who vote Republican, right?
So right.
40 something percent of women vote Republican overall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know.
But there's also a good chunk that don't like that kind of thing within the Democratic.
Yes, that's true. And I mean, it's a crazy thing, though, right? So even her concession speech, if you will, she said, you know, in response to a question that was more or less planted, you know, what role did sexism play? And she said, well, you know, I'm stuck here because if I say it's due to sexism, I sound like a whiner. And if I say it's not due to sexism, most women say, what world do you live in? What planet are you from? Right. That was her concession speech. And I felt like, okay, so really, she decided strategically to be, you know, a woman candidate, meaning she's going to try to get women to vote for her because she's a woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just, and we, you know, coming out of 2016 with the pussy hat protests and vote with your pussy, I mean, that was discourse. That's real discourse in the Democratic Party. That's real. That's a real constituency. Yeah, she wagered on that. You know, I don't think that that's just her psychology. I think that it's somewhere between a sincere belief and a strategy. But it's a strategy. You know, we have to consider it as a real strategy. And the Bernie bros have a reputation. And, you know, I've read many essays about, you know, from liberal women who are like, they don't like Bernie Sanders because he's loud.
Yeah.
You know? They're turned off. He's a man who's yelling. A man who's yelling. Right?
Mm.
And so it's like, what do you do with that? You know, so cultural politics are real. Cultural politics are real. And all the politicians play cultural politics to more or less extent.
Well, it's interesting. I'll just tell you another personal anecdote. My parents were both Klobuchar people.
Uh-huh.
which really puzzled me. I didn't even know
what is her appeal. Like, in other words, what is her appeal? Yes, I mean, her appeal is a conservative appeal. It's a conservative appeal. She's the woman you can relate to, right? She's the kind of woman you want to see in politics. That's that. Yeah. She's
I guess.
Relatable. She's a relatable woman who you'd like to see in politics, who seems like she cares, but, you know, she's strong, but she's not some kind of a scary feminist, you know? And it's like, that's a conservative appeal. I mean, at the end of the day, probably the first woman president will be a Republican.
And oh, yeah.
For this reason, right? So, you know.
But the second part of that story, though, interestingly, is when she dropped out and I talked to my mother, and she lives in Colorado, so they voted before Klobuchar dropped out. Uh-huh. So they had already put their votes in. I said, so if you hadn't done that already, who would you vote for? You know, Tulsi, Bernie, or Biden? And my mother really could not decide. She doesn't like Biden. Mm-hmm. But then later on, she said, I would never vote for Bernie. Why? Because he's loud and strident. And, you know, and all
nice this. Anti-Semitic caricature there, too, by the way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Jews so, are loud.
Yeah.
I mean, fuck. I just don't, you know, I don't know. I'm from New York. I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me at all.
It doesn't make any sense to me, but this is real.
It's yeah, real, but man. This it doesn't seem real to me. It seems so phony. All of this stuff
you mean
seems
contrived.
Right. Yes.
Well, reality, you know, especially at a cultural and psychological level, is largely contrived.
Right.
You know.
But I guess as a Marxist, I kind of feel like, okay, people come up with rationales. Mm-hmm. That sound like this, but they actually have real material interests, which are moving their political decisions. But
maybe sometimes. Often it's very unclear, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like the difference between Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, or between Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, it's like what are we debating here? So, all right. So now the question is, how do we develop a socialist politics in this context and coming out of this process?
There's no socialist politics to come out of the Democratic Party. No way.
Or the Republican Party.
No. Right.
Right.
So obviously, you know, if there were to be an actual socialist politics in the United States, it would draw on people who now vote for Republicans and Democrats, of course.
Mm.
But not at the level of voting either. In other words, I think my own perspective on this is that any potential socialist politics has to be built independently of elections, completely independently of elections. Like, it has nothing to do with any of it, right? Because it has to be built independently of the laws that are on the books.
Like, mm-hmm.
It has to be developed regardless of who's in office, regardless of the laws on the books, regardless of government administrative policies. It's got to happen at the level of civil society. It's got to happen at the level of, you know, actual social power, you know, vis-a-vis all sorts of, you know, interests, if you will, and institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So it really cannot be about getting the people in power, whether in government or in society, to change their behavior, right? It can't be this kind of appeal
mm-hmm.
to, you know, to them to do the right thing. It's got to be social power that can be exercised, you know, regardless of stated policies and positions of the people in power have.
Do you think some of the demands might sound very much like Bernie Sanders demands that would come out of that kind of movement? Like, we want to get rid of Taft-Hartley. We want to get rid of the card check. We want Medicare for all. We want free public education. Would these be demands that a socialist project could take up?
Possibly. You know, I always like to point out that at the level of high politics, you know, the old like Social Democratic Party of Germany or the Socialist Party of America, they won no legislation, like, ever, right?
Right.
They at most implemented municipal administrative measures at most. Mm-hmm. You know, usually of a more or less uncontroversial character. But otherwise, they voted no on everything. In state assemblies, in Congress, in the Reichstag, right, in Parliament, they voted no to everything.
Yeah. Do you think that should be our model, the old German Social Democratic Party?
Yeah, I mean, I still believe in the necessity, right? Not the desirability, but the necessity of political revolution, meaning actual political revolution, which could happen through some quasi-electoral means, of course. Mm-hmm. It could happen through a political governmental crisis due to a plurality or a majority of legislative representation, you know, by a socialist party. But that would be, you know, a crisis meaning an inability to govern otherwise.
Right.
So that's still a revolution. And so, you know, I mean, otherwise, you know, I mean, look, this is going to sound like, Trump Republican Party nowadays talking points. Mm-hmm. The deep state is real. Deep state is real.
Oh, well, they're real. I'm old enough to know that that's the case. It's not a Republican talking point. I mean, I know
It's become that. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, because basically who drafts legislation and who drafts policy memos? The bureaucracy, the deep state, and NGOs. And the strongest NGOs are the capitalist corporations, meaning legislators don't draft legislation in this environment. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
Lobbyists do.
Yeah, but there are also like organizations like OSPRG or consumer rights organizations or citizen groups that try to pass.
Those are lobbyists.
Yeah, I know. NGOs. I know. Yeah. But they're NGOs, but they're not the NGOs that you mentioned. I think they're more representative of everyday people. Like, you don't think so? Like a bottle bill.
Representative of very particular petty bourgeois interests.
Right.
You know, and certainly even when they're not, and they often are directly representative of such interests, their horizon of politics is entirely identical with those kinds of interests.
But if you want to find young Marxists, at least in the 90s, if you wanted to find somebody who might end up like me, a Marxist, you'd go and I work for OSPRG in the 90s. The rank and file of these organizations, the people who go door to door, they're often some level of socialist or free.
Yeah, they exploit your good intentions. But, you know, that doesn't characterize the purpose or actual activity of these organizations. Meaning you would have been much better off working for a for-profit company.
Oh, of course.
Right? Yeah. I mean, you know, so, you know, they just, you know, yeah. I mean, they exploit people who are not representative of their actual mandate. So, you know, I mean, again, people should work for whomever, you know. In other words, a proletarian socialist perspective is that employment's not a morality choice.
Right.
It's not. Right. In other words, the working class that needs to be addressed as a constituency for socialism are people who have to work for whatever job is available to keep them alive.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was doing. I dropped out of college and I just, they would hire me. Mm-hmm. The standard was relatively low, so I got in the door. Mm-hmm. But okay, so this is all kind of coming together for me, but I'm still a little unclear as to like what the difference in the character of an old like the European Social Democratic Parties and structure is from like the American Democratic Party today, because it seems like I cannot imagine that political decisions were made based on whether or not someone felt that a candidate was loud or, you know, this sort of demographic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that seems very modern and contemporary. Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know, there were still issues of charisma and aesthetics and style. Other words, not everyone was meant to be like a kind of representative, you know, the kind of public face or you know, in terms of running for office, you know, so they had Rosa Luxemburg do stump speeches and they had Rosa Luxemburg teach at the party school, but she never ran for the Reichstag. I mean, of course, she wasn't qualified to at that point because there wasn't female suffrage yet. But you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, that's why people look back at this stuff. I mean, look, what's happened is we're living over a century, the last century. The left has been reduced to a kind of marginal pressure group adjunct to the global New Deal,
mm-hmm.
meaning starting with FDR and the Popular Front in the 1930s, the Communist parties, Socialist parties to a lesser extent, although after World War II, Social Democratic parties, they became assimilated to the Democratic Party as the dominant party in the United States, and the United States is the dominant state in the world. And that only really changed starting in the 70s with the neoliberal turn.
Right.
But it still is there. In other words, what social democracy was in post-World War II Europe, you know, I was joking with my friend Spencer Leonard about how it's easy to implement the welfare state when you have people living on rations, which is what was going on in Western Europe after World War II. And right. people don't know this, but there was restricted rationing of food. There was a caloric intake.
I'm aware of this. Fact.
Yeah, people are living on 1,000 calories a day.
Right.
You know, which is pretty svelte.
Yeah. Right?
And that's why Europeans have this, you know, reputation for being thin, because in the 50s and 60s, they were. And it's right. because they were living on rations. And so if you have a military situation where you have bombed out countries, people living on rations, it's pretty straightforward to implement a welfare state under those conditions. Yeah. And the welfare state that was implemented was a global New Deal. It was not social democracy in the pre-World War II, let alone pre-World War I vision of social democracy. Not at
right.
all.
Right. Yeah. But now that is social democracy. That's what we think of when we think of social democracy is FDR and, right. and the New Deal.
In other words, something very conservative and right wing.
Yeah. And yeah. Right.
Which the new left, you know, in their mania and hysteria, called fascism.
Right.
There was the new left called LBJ a fascist. The Great Society was fascism.
Right. I remember.
Which is overwrought and hysteric and absurd, but there's a kernel of truth to it.
Yeah. And they, and you know, they, the Soviets would call social democrats social fascists.
Social fascists.
Well.
Yeah. And then, yeah. of course, they would call the Soviets red fascists. It's all right. mostly true. Right. From the standpoint of actual socialism, it's all more or less true. I mean, obviously, it's ridiculous rhetoric and it's polemic. Mm-hmm. But the kernel of truth is that none of this has anything to do with historic socialism. The anarchists are right about that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. So I guess, you know, the one thing that bothers me about you, Chris, is that you will say all these things, and then you seem confident in the ability of a workers' party to come together that won't just reproduce some of these same dynamics. And I don't see the way forward for that. I guess maybe I just haven't hung around.
No, I mean, look, I'm not confident that it will actually happen, but it is what is necessary to happen.
Right.
And you know, what I always like to say is, of course, the historic experience. I mean, we have to distinguish a couple of things. So, you know, 100 years ago, there was a split in Marxism between revolutionary communism, reformist, counter-revolutionary social democracy. Right.
Right.
But we're not really dealing with that. What we're dealing with now is a 60s era aversion to the party. Right, where the party, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or the Communist Party of China, against whom Mao launched the Cultural Revolution, bombarded the headquarters, it looks like the party is a counter-revolutionary institution. Right, that it always yeah. was that, you know, Noam Chomsky will say the Bolsheviks were the most cunning counter-revolutionaries. They were not revolutionaries, they were the most cunning counter-revolutionaries.
Right.
They tricked the workers into supporting them, and then they suppress the workers' revolution, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason that they're counter-revolutionary is that they represented the coordinator class, like the managerial intelligentsia class, mm-hmm. and that this is what is preventing socialism, and it's what's keeping the working class down. Okay, right? So, yes, that's a danger. That is a danger.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the alternative? The alternative is what we have now, which is a bureaucratic capitalist state, right? Mm-hmm. With very little political accountability whatsoever of any kind at all,
mm-hmm.
right? Not much democracy at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for instance, I don't know if you read about this. This is somewhat apocryphal, but it was reported that when Trump assassinated Soleimani,
mm-hmm.
right? That he had been given a palette of choices, of options, but
I read this.
And this was put on there as like the crazy option that he of course will not take.
Right.
And he took it, and they were like, fuck, he took the crazy option. And I feel like, you know, Trump's pretty intelligent, meaning he's like, they gave him cover. In other words, they presented it as an option. He took it. And because they presented it as an option, no one could impugn it. No one could say, oh, see what how crazy Trump is. It's like they presented it as an option.
Yeah, no, that's when I read that, I said, if this is such a crazy option, why did the establishment put it on their menu?
Because they're used to dealing with people like Obama or George W. Bush. They're used to manipulating politicians in a particular way, and Trump outfoxed them. And he also thought it was the right thing to do, meaning he is very much like on this wavelength of like, the mullahs in Iran or Kim Jong-un, he's like, this is the language that they understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is also true, meaning he's a gangster, they're gangsters. This is effective, in fact, mm-hmm. But in a way that's obviously dangerous and what have you. But, he intuited that this was the peace option, right? In other words, that rather than airstrikes against Iran or airstrikes against Shia militants in Iraq or something like that, you just kill one guy, you know, and a few other people who happen to be with him,
mm-hmm.
right? And that they would get the message and whatever, right? It's the same way, you know, when he did Fire and Fury against North Korea and people were like, oh, he's going to start World War III. And it's like, no, you know, he's speaking the language that can be understood. And he's also presenting a cover for his, negotiating partners to make some noise and retreat. So it's just, you know, again, democracy. I mean,
that kind of talk, that's the kind of talk that drives, I think, a lot of people on the left crazy when you say that.
They're just concerned with morality. They're not concerned with reality. And reality is we live in a world where wars still take place, right? And Iran foments wars in the Middle East. Largely as a defensive measure, by the way. Largely as a defensive measure, meaning they are threatened. The Iran-Iraq war was horrible. They've had the experience of being attacked, being invaded, and the world being complicit in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from their perspective, it's defensive. I'm not saying from Iranians' perspective, but from the regime's perspective. You know, they involve themselves in Yemen and Syria and Lebanon and Iraq. Largely to, you know, for geopolitical reasons that are understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the U.S. is in this position of managing competing interests. In other words, you can't pretend the world isn't as it is. The world is as it is. And the United States manages local geopolitical hotspots, you know, conflicts between Turkey and Russia, for Christ's sake.
What I'm doing right now is I am listening to, but I'm also turning on our super chat option. Because I forgot to do it at the start of this video. So when people want to ask questions, they can also have the option of giving us some money. They don't have to, of course, and we will take questions without doing that. But I want to make sure that...
I feel like I'm a stripper. I'm a pole dance, right? But they're going to offer dollars based on my moves.
Yeah, well, you know, yes. So let me just turn this on. And... but I also want to give people an opportunity to ask us questions. Again, you don't have to make a donation, but now, because I remembered, you can if you want to. And that's, you know, that's the name of the game. while we wait for the one thing about YouTube streaming is that what we're saying now, they're hearing in about a minute.
Oh, okay. So a little bit of lag.
Yeah. Cool. So what I will say to you at this point is one of the reasons I invited you on to the stream and wanted to talk to you, and I actually asked you last Tuesday after this defeat, was because I felt like I would feel better if I talked to you rather than if I talked to anyone else on the left. Because, boy, I tell you, people are feeling pretty devastated at this point. There was a lot of expectation, not just amongst, you know, young people, but around, you know, people in their millennials, the people who are coming up as in their careers on the left, who really were invested in becoming a part of a new movement and a new structure of power and a new center of power in this country. And that's all going to fall apart. And it's not like it was all, you know, personal, although it was. People did want to further their career through the Bernie Sanders movement. But it was also that they felt, you know, that real human needs would be met. I would say
a movement isn't falling apart, but an electoral campaign, you know, will suffer some defeat and disappointment. You know, this is the danger, right? And so, you know, the DSA has also gone in pretty heavily with the Bernie campaign. And I think that, you know, again, but it's all very aspirational, isn't it? In other words, you get the sense that neither Bernie nor a lot of his more perspicacious supporters were really in earnest about it. In other words, that it wasn't really about winning the nomination or winning office, that it's about building a movement. And I agree with my old mentor, Adolf Reed. I don't think electoral campaigns are how you build movements.
But Reed is a big supporter of Bernie Sanders. And I think do you think he thought that Sanders could win this time?
No.
No. Okay.
No. I mean, he was approached in 2016 by a member of Platypus here in Chicago about his endorsement of Bernie. And he said, look, I'm old and this is the best I'm going to see in my lifetime. And yeah, I know. You know, he was like, look, I know. But.
So Bernie, you don't think Bernie wanted to win or thought he could win? And you don't think that most of the people in his movement were running the campaign?
Bhaskar Sankara, Jacobin DSA, no. They did not, no.
But did they have a strategy for where what they were going to do after? What the next step is to bring forward a movement then out of this, if that was the goal?
Well, look at what they did after 2016. They basically tried to do local electoralism.
Mm-hmm.
Of which they had some success in 2018.
Right.
So they will continue to do that. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, they're going to try to establish a progressive constituency within the Democratic Party. And maybe, you know, hope to increase the polarization in American politics to move the so-called Overton window, which I don't believe in that concept. But, you know, maybe the idea is that if local government and representatives in Congress from the coasts are more and more progressive, then somehow you'll move the needle of American politics towards more old style, New Deal style consensus, as opposed to the neoliberal consensus. But the neoliberal consensus is over anyway. It's done anyway. So that's the other thing, is that they're kind of beating a dead horse on that one.
Right. Okay. So first question, we got $2. You can put that in your underwear. Actually, you can't. That's going to us. Do you think Biden can take on Trump?
Could. You know, he has his good days and his bad days. He has his good moments and his bad moments. But, you know, it's going to be a little bit of a bloodbath. Like, the debates are going to be a bloodbath. And I think that would be true no matter who they put up against Trump.
You don't think Bernie could do better?
Bernie could do reasonably well. However, people are just not prepared for Trump, what he represents. Like, in other words, all the debates in Congress, like the political careers that people have not prepared them for this. You know, they really don't know what they're up against. You know, they see the same sound bites as everyone else with Trump. I don't think that they watch the full Trump rallies the way I do. And, you know, they don't see this guy is just, you know. Now, that is more or less consequential, meaning, like in 2016, there is a little bit of a race to the bottom aspect of this whole thing, which is to say, the Democrats try to depress Republican turnout by you know, getting people turned off to Trump and his bad rhetoric. And similarly, Trump tries to depress enthusiasm for the Democrats. So there's a race to the bottom aspect of that. And then the question is, where does it bottom out? Like, where is the core constituency?
Mm-hmm.
There are obviously swing voters, and they could swing back and forth. And Biden obviously is the candidate to try to win back the so-called Reagan Democrats. So I have an anecdote. Can I just say the anecdote? The anecdote is this. Right after Obama was elected, I happened to go back to Long Island to visit my family for a family event. I don't think it was Christmas. I think it was something else. There was something else that brought me to New York closer to the election. I don't remember exactly what it was. And my extended family said, well, what do you think about this Obama? You know, you're from Chicago. And, you know, and I said, well, you know, I'm not very enthusiastic about Obama, but, you know, he's fine. And they were like, well, the one thing is, at least Biden is the vice president. And I thought, why do you think that Biden is any different from Obama? And then I realized it's because he's an Irish Catholic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my family is Italian Catholic. A lot of them are, a good proportion of them are Irish Catholic. And they were just like comforted by that, right? In other words, they are the proverbial Reagan Democrats, meaning the Catholic vote, right? That swings back and forth. And I just thought, shit, is it really that parochial? Is it really that tribal? Unfortunately, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now I don't know how that plays exactly quite in the Midwest, Rust Belt, swing vote, swing states in the Electoral College. It could help Biden in Pennsylvania. I don't know if it helps in Wisconsin and Michigan in the same way. I don't know.
What do you think about the cognitive decline argument against Biden?
I mean, clearly something's going on there with him. I mean, I've been watching the Democrat debates. I've been watching Biden's speeches. And, you know, it's not a nervous stutter. You know, they tried to say that. They tried to say, you know, he's developed a stutter.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't attack someone with a disability like a stutter.
Right.
And it's more than that. You know, there was an apocryphal report about how he didn't intend to serve more than one term.
Yeah.
He was elected. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's real. You know, it's real. Yeah. I mean, people were saying this about Trump, which is absurd. Trump is clearly in command of his faculties. He's more or less interested in the issues of the day, meaning like at certain press conferences, certain issues. Clearly, he doesn't care about certain things.
He speaks differently now than he did when he was younger.
Trump?
He's less coached. Yes.
Yes.
He's
more. Well, there's a difference between becoming an old man and dementia.
Right.
So becoming an old man, you become cranky.
Right.
Right.
I'm noticing this in myself.
I'm noticing it in myself. Right. So you become less concerned with polish.
Right.
Right. And you are more like to the point.
Mm-hmm.
Brusque.
Yeah.
That's definitely true with Trump. But with Biden, you know, I mean, he's got some of that. He's got some old man crankiness. But he's also got some fade out, like in mid-sentence fade out.
Yeah.
Like it's real, you know,
yeah.
And sometimes he's better than others, but that's also in the nature of whatever it might be.
Do you think that will actually hurt him?
Yeah.
In the general? Okay.
Yes.
Despite the tribalism, despite the fact that like, okay, I'd like to put my senile old Catholic uncle or a grandfather up into the White House.
I think it will depress enthusiasm. It will depress turnout.
Yeah.
I think that's it, you know, it will affect in that way. It won't cause people to go vote for Trump instead of him. It will cause people to not vote.
But the Democrats must know this. So are they putting someone up to lose to Trump?
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta measure that too. In other words, it's always the incumbent's race to lose, meaning there is a presumption of a re-election of an incumbent president. It's very rare for it not to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And even with Trump being, you know, very unusual, when these sort of first term elections, the candidate is always more or less a sacrificial victim.
Mm-hmm. So why not sacrifice Bernie again? Why not make him your nominee?
Why not?
Kill him in the let him lose the general, and then you can blame that whole wing of the Democratic Party and suppress all of that much more effectively. They guess they don't want to risk him winning.
See, he winning is not such a problem because he'd have to staff his administration with all Democrats, normal people, and you know. He'd face maybe a Democrat majority Congress, maybe a Republican majority Congress, but he'd face both Republicans and Democrats who are opposed to him. You know, Trump has spent the first term basically weeding out all the internal sabotage of his own administration by established Republicans. Right? Mm-hmm. That's been what's been going on the whole time. So that only in the last year, maybe at most, maybe not even, have you seen Trump actually pursuing his real agenda, right, that what he wants to do, as opposed to all the compromises he had to make early on. And so you'd have that, in other words, a Bernie administration, like, you know, at a certain level, there is no reason why not, but there also is no reason why. In other words, do they really have to concede to Bernie Sanders, right? In other words, the Democrats are not yet willing to say, we're so desperate, we got to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Republicans can only win with Trump.
Mm.
Like the Republicans but are stuck with him.
The whole thing that we just said was they're putting Biden up to lose, and therefore they don't have to give in to Bernie. Whereas Republicans can win with Trump, can only win with Trump. But I think the Republicans, the establishment, was very much willing to lose to Hillary.
Some. And I worry about that happening this year, right? In other words, my concern is that Trump will not be learn the lesson from. In other words, for me, the Trump phenomenon, because obviously I have no, you know, leaving all magical thinking aside, please.
Mm-hmm.
What I think and what I say has no bearing whatsoever on who's elected, who's not elected. It just has no bearing whatsoever. So what bearing does it have? Not on reality, on what's going to happen, but on how we think about it.
Well, you can go on Tucker and then say something that will affect how Trump does, because he watches Tucker Carlson. That could happen.
Oh, yeah, well, that's true, too. But the thing is, I mean, this is why, like, I also think that window might be closing, meaning Tucker is kind of steering his own kind of agenda in a particular way. And, you know, I thought that the primaries might be an opportunity for him to have what he considers to be socialists or social democrats on his show in order to play this kind of game of, like, if you really meant what you said, then I would support you, but you don't. You're just a shill for the Democrats, and so I don't. Like Cornel West, he's had on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Cornel West gave a speech in favor of Bernie recently, and that speech probably means Tucker won't have Cornel West on for a while because Tucker's more interested in condemning Bernie as a socialist, communist, whatever, right?
Right.
And so, you know, things shift in that regard. So, but getting back to it, I think that, of course, the Democrats are going to try to win. They're going to try to win.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have not learned the lessons of 2016. Clearly they have not. They feel like it was a fluke and it can't be repeated. Trump's win, you know, is, you know, can't really be repeated. You know, there's a lack of imagination there. I mean, really, you know, again, it's cost and benefits, it's risk assessment, and it's upsides and downsides. And Bernie is a marginal figure from their perspective, has too many downsides, right? And not enough upsides. Because they know that this millennial enthusiasm for socialism is passing. It's a passing phenomenon. It's not the future.
Doesn't every generation go through its infatuation with socialism?
Not our generation.
Oh, I think our generation did, at least in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, anarchism.
Not in massive ways, not in a way that could affect elections.
Okay. All
right. Right. So we didn't, you know, we didn't live through the Great Recession. We didn't live through the crisis that has actually happened. So there's a real crisis of a bipartisan consensus in the United States.
But wasn't the WTO protests in Seattle in 99 kind of the end of the road for Generation X's leftism?
It was, and look at how limited that was.
I know.
You know, yeah. In other words, that was very limited. And, you know, it was spectacular in the sense that it caught media attention, but it didn't represent an actual counterforce to the Washington consensus. But, you know, the millennial generation has lived through something that we did not live through. And that's the war on terror, which has been a debacle.
We did live through it, just as older people.
We lived through the Cold War. Oh, yeah, we lived through it as old people, right? But we lived through the Cold War, which was different. Mm. And, you know, in terms of a formative experience, like their formative experience is a total debacle of neoconservatism and neoliberalism.
Right.
And an exposure of the cynicism of the Christian right. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that they live through, like, their generation is like actually much more Christian right than our generation was. In other words, like much more of them were actually raised by the Christian right than we were.
Mm-hmm.
And but they've also seen its cynicism thereby, right, as a mm-hmm. result. And so all the wings, if you will, of the Republican Reagan coalition and the degree to which it also encompassed a kind of Washington consensus bipartisan kind of framework.
Mm-hmm.
They've seen all the legs get knocked out from under it. And that's a significant historical experience that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there is no alternative.
Right.
At the end of the day, the Democrats are trying to put those things back in place.
But they're doing it with a senile old man.
Who else is there?
Well, I guess.
Our generation blew it. Like, Obama was our generation's president. And otherwise, I think now the torch is passed to the millennials.
Right.
And I think the future is going to be the Buttigieg type people.
Hmm.
You know?
So why is there no more Gen X? I mean, we're Gen X people. Like, I guess Klobuchar is Gen X, right?
Yeah, we're useless. Our generation is a lost generation, wasted, useless.
It's the best generation. How dare you say that about Gen X and slacker movies and Nirvana?
We had our fun. We did have our fun. But, you know, in terms of world history, useless. We're useless.
All right. Well, now we're done with this conversation. Crossed the line. Supporting Trump
You know, we're not entirely useless in that we can tell younger people about why we were useless.
No, okay.
Don't make our mistakes, children.
See, you're talking to a guy who realized he was not in his 20s when he hit 40. So it's not a...
That's true for all of us. And, you know, with the boomers, do they ever...
Right.
Do they ever recognize that they're not in their 20s? Ever?
I don't think they did. No. Yeah.
So, you know, at least, you know, we hit middle age. The boomers kind of never did.
Yeah. Well, this is very depressing.
You know,
thanks a lot.
Gives us a simulacrum of respectability. We can say, we're middle aged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Like, It's hilarious to me. I have young people come up to me and actually pay respect. They're very respectful to me. Like I know something. Like, you know, like I know more than they do. And I know. It's hard
you
for
do.
Me to get.
Yeah. So let's not waste it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see if there are any more questions, but I feel like we're maybe coming to the end here.
Right.
That was nicely depressing. I don't know if I'm going to get canceled at the end of this because we exposed all these. We went after Bernie pretty hard here.
I've got nothing against Bernie. what he's trying to do, I wish him all the best in what he's trying to do. But it has reached certain limits.
Right.
I wish that the limits were not as low as they are. Right. I'd be happy to see Bernie win the nomination and get elected president. I have nothing against it. Really nothing against it. And nothing really against him.
You would prefer him to Trump for sure, right?
Sure.
Yeah. But not passionately or anything. But yeah.
I mean,
but
it's because you know, I'm aware of what that really means.
Right.
You know? And so and again, I'm not going to get myself too worked up over it because I know it's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, and the young people, the problem is that they didn't know and they should have known.
Well, let me tell you what my perspective was on this. And it was something I was kind of formulating as it went along. I mean, at first I told my kid to go into the DSA, not because, and it was, a mistake that I suggested this to my kid that he go into the DSA. Because he's a leftist now, you know,
he was a math major
and now he's a leftist. But the other, the other thing was I thought he could go in, kind of give me the lay of the land and not get infected. And, well, and
I
mean, he did.
Look, I wish it weren't that, like, in other words, I think it's like, you know, I would never tell people don't join the DSA because you're going to get infected with bad leftism. I would say rather that they might have a depressing experience. In other words, they might be subject to meetings in which people denounce each other and this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, he did.
And that's a bad experience to have, although it's salutary, I guess, in some ways. But it breeds cynicism, I think.
That's what I mean. Not that he became, you know, one of these leftoids or something, but that he believes in socialism and he doesn't see any way forward with it.
Well, that might be useful too. In other words, it might be useful to have it all be spent that way in the DSA. In other words, just flame out, done.
Yeah, well, he's not quite there yet. He might turn out like me, just lingering on into his...
Oh, I think that they will. I think that they will. How old's your son?
He's 23.
Oh, okay, so young still.
Zoomer.
Like not in his like mid to late 30s, like the older cohort of
No, he's not. He's actually a Zoomer. He's right on the cusp. Yeah.
Zoomer. Yeah. Because I feel like these millennials who are in their 30s, who are like canvassing, knocking on doors, I'm like, you know, damn, that's for people in their 20s. You're not that naive anymore. You know, you don't have that excuse.
Right.
You know.
So here's another... But $5 for a socialist should radicalize Bernie Bros by pointing out the limitations of Sanders and his electoral politics. The DSA must also be criticized.
For sure. I agree 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But it's still amazing to me that what happened. Okay. I was telling you my whole, you know, thought about the DSA. So my kid went into the DSA. Then, like a year ago, I said, so what's going on with them? What kind of projects are they doing? And he says, well, it's just, we get literature from the central committee or, you know, the people on top send us literature. We're supposed to go out and distribute it. We're mostly infiltrated by the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. You can tell the Democratic operatives, they come here, they give us terrible advice and they're wreckers really. And then, you know, and then people flow through and no one sticks around very much. And I think we're all just sort of gearing up to campaign for Bernie Sanders, which isn't what I wanted to do. But then Bernie Sanders campaign starts and then it's all of that's forgotten. We have to get on the Sanders campaign.
Yes.
For me, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of my friends are, and not just friends, colleagues, professional colleagues, Sanders people. Mm-hmm. And I really like the guy. I think, you know, and I want health care for all. I want these things. So I get more and more kind of interested in that, trying to maintain a critical distance, you know, the United Front, not the Popular Front, maybe.
Can I say one thing about Medicare for all?
Yeah.
Because I didn't like talk about this in my article, Why Not Trump Again? It's very short. You know, I couldn't get into any issues of substance. Mm-hmm. I don't think Medicare for all is such a great idea. Because it's still private healthcare. Why do you want to give tax money to private health providers?
Well, it's a nationalized healthcare.
But it's still private hospitals, private doctors, private pharmaceutical companies. I mean, I guess the idea would be that somehow you would, I don't know, like decrease the profit margins.
It's not like the NHS, right?
It's not like the NHS. In other words, right. You know, a national health service where the doctors are employees of this government, right? Which, you know, there's a socialist criticism of that too.
Of but course.
We're not even talking about that. We're talking about using public funds to prop up a private industry.
Affordable Care Act did, the ACA.
Yes. I mean, although they did it, I guess what they did was they propped up private insurance companies too, which is even more outrageous. No, I mean, the Affordable right. Care Act, Obamacare was horrible. It was originally a Heritage Foundation idea and, you know, bears that. In other words, it was to the right of what Hillary Clinton proposed early in the Bill Clinton administration.
Right. Well, why? But okay, so if Bernie Sanders was smart, he would start with an NHS style, real socialized medicine proposal and then be pushed back into Medicare for all rather than start with Medicare for all. I don't know.
Yeah, the thing is, like, it's a funny thing, right? Because the medical industry is an actual constituency.
Right.
And it's a constituency of the Democratic Party. And, you know, medical school is very expensive. Medical malpractice insurance is very expensive. Doctors have to be paid a certain amount to pay off their student loans and pay for medical malpractice insurance. And that's one thing that's very hard to cut the costs of. But then there are administrative costs.
I'm a doctor's son.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in a neighborhood that was filled with doctors and stockbrokers.
Uh-huh.
These people don't just get paid enough to pay off their malpractice.
No, they get paid more than that. But
they get paid to be, you know, well, they're millionaires.
The way you'd have a national health service in the United States is you would import all your doctors from India, pay them much less,
mm-hmm.
and have it be publicly provided that way. That's the only way. Really, you'd have to have people who are educated elsewhere. You know, it's a whole racket here.
Well, I know that in the UK, like my wife's a nurse, and in the UK, the person who works with me on the YouTube channel, his wife's a nurse. We're both freeloaders. Mm-hmm. And
nurses are like, do a lot of what doctors used to do.
Right. But my wife, who just started working as a nurse, she went through nursing school and mm-hmm. finished a year ago, or 8 months ago. She's paid a whole lot more than the UK counterpart. And the difference is, I think, she works for the VA hospital here. She's paid mm-hmm. probably twice as much in mm-hmm. real terms mm-hmm. as the, or maybe not quite because of the difference between the pound and the dollar, but really significantly more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's that does tend to make the struggle even for something like the NHS a little harder because
the constituents.
Yeah,
yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard to break out of where we're at with that. I mean, the other thing is that obviously one of the service economy, the so-called service economy, and the information economy,
mm-hmm.
And the intellectual property economy, the U.S. is a place where medical technology, pharmaceuticals are developed. You know, this is one of the industries that keeps the U.S. centrally placed in the global economy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a sacred cow that won't be slain very easily. Assuming that, of course, it should be. In other words, again, you know, socialism, you know, is a different path. It's a different path from capitalist state management of the economy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always tell people, like my students, you know, we're more likely to get a national health service out of Trump than out of the Democrats. And the only reason that it would be done ever, and the reason it would be more likely to be done by someone like Trump, is that it would be a cost-cutting measure. It would be made on pure business grounds. It would just mm-hmm. be like, we want to rationalize American capitalism, cut costs, and we're going to do it this way. It's never going to happen by calling it socialism.
Right.
That kills it. It's like Paul Krugman is right. So I watched a Paul Krugman debate with Richard Wolff.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Krugman was like, you know, the problem with Sanders and his followers is that they shoot themselves in the foot by calling what they want socialism. It's not socialism, and they shouldn't call it socialism. It's just an ideological liability to call it socialism. And maybe the U.S. should have these things, but it's never going to get them under the label socialism. And that's true, right? And Paul Krugman is just a capitalist. He's just a liberal, progressive, Keynesian capitalist economist. And he's right about that. But that's not socialism. And it's true. And socialists ought to struggle for something else.
But there's a reason why they do it, though. The reason they call it socialism is the same reason why I called, I interviewed Bill Ivey, who was a friend of Podesta's, and, you know, whose email got released by WikiLeaks 4 years ago.
He's one of those characters,
Yeah, and he's like, he was a former head of the National Endowment for the Arts and New Podesta and all that. And I interviewed him. And I said, you know, you're on a Marxist podcast. And so, oh, I'm a Marxist, too. I'm basically a Marxist. And, right?
You know, we're 100 years into this, Doug. Meaning, you know, there have been generations of enlightened capitalists who are like, yeah, Marx is right. Now, of course, they just mean certain things, right?
Right.
So they're not for the dictatorship of the proletariat. And not because they're against it, but because they don't think it will work.
Right.
You know, this is the other thing that we have to remember about the right wing. The right wing is not like against socialism. They're not like against like good things. They just don't think it will work. They don't think it's possible.
Right, I know.
And you know what? It's not clear that it is possible. Right? So I'm someone who's been infected with ideas, Marxism, I think it might be possible and that it's worth struggling for, even if it doesn't, in a sense, work out, meaning I'm for, like, let's try it. Let's try the global dictatorship of the proletariat, and then we can talk about whether Marx was right or not.
I think that we don't, but I think that something different than what we have now that's more, that's going to give everyone more freedom is certainly possible.
I think so too. Yeah. But, you know, we don't have concrete examples to point to show that that's the case.
Yeah, but clearly it's possible because, you know, what we do now was inconceivable 200 years ago.
Yes.
You know, clearly what we do know for sure is that we create our own conditions as much as our conditions create us. We know all that. So that can't be denied. So now the real question is, it's possible in theory.
But as a tangible felt possibility, right? So, you know, 19th century liberals, right? Mm-hmm. Like a John Stuart Mill or a Herbert Spencer, or even like old style liberal progressives, like a Teddy Roosevelt, or even an FDR, right? Who made a lot of concessions in the New Deal coalition to conservatism and the Democratic Party, much more than TR would have. They would be horrified at the world that we live in now. They would, because the world that we live in now is much less democratic, much less liberal than even 100 years ago, American high politics capitalism, right? Let alone then its aspirations and ambitions and felt
something like that. Though, you got to take into account that in the you're going to be called racist because more people are included in our democratic society now than were then.
You mean as people to be manipulated? Yeah, sure.
Well, but
that's a lot wider now. In other words, now, like, you know, women have to be pandered to, whereas they could be ignored in the 30s and 40s, right? Now they have to be appealed to by the mass marketing manipulation apparatus. Yeah, you've come a long way, baby.
I think that's an improvement. I'd rather have to be pandered to than ignored.
No, I think that old style feminists would be horrified. Right. Yeah. Old style suffragettes, old style feminists would be horrified that women have just been turned into a market.
Right. Okay. That I agree with. But
they'd be horrified. Not even socialists, just liberal feminists of 100 years ago would be horrified at what's been the result.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that sometime. But we've been talking.
Virginia Woolf, Three Guineas.
Okay.
Three Guineas. Right. She says, you know, she would take one guinea to burn down the women's college, one guinea to burn down the Women's Professional Organization and one guinea to burn down the pacifist organization, right? Because it's all about how, like, well, if women were in charge, we wouldn't have wars. And if women were educated, the world would be a better place. And if women ran businesses, the world would be a better place. And Virginia Woolf was like, you got to be kidding. Right? She's like, look, of course, if women were elected to office and if women ran capitalist corporations and if women were more educated, the world would be pretty much exactly the way it is.
Yeah. And
she was right.
There she was. So where
She's
in the
not
world
a Marxist.
Are, yeah, I know. Where in the world are socialist movements strong? Someone asked for $1.99.
For $1.99? That won't even get you on the subway anymore. Socialist movements, nowhere.
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Socialist movements.
Yeah.
Nowhere. Nowhere. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, I can't go with Nepal or, you know, the Naxalites. No. I mean, as much as I'd love to, not really. You know, those are the only things that spring to mind. You know, movements. Yeah. No place. So given that fact, why not in the belly of the beast?
Yeah.
Why not? You know,
Do you think
it's gotta be,
you think that this election will change the dynamic on the left, that the resistance is going to be weaker after this election than it was the last 4 years? That
there'll be some depoliticization, there'll be some demoralization, and that's not a bad thing necessarily, right? Because all of the, you know, enthusiasm and morale was just, you know, to be more or less used by the Democrats. You know, I declared the millennial left dead 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's irreversible judgment. That's the judgment of history. That's not my judgment. Of history. You know, I gave the best years of my life to trying to educate the millennial left. You know, so we'll see with the Zoomers. We'll see with the next generation. But, you know, now the millennials, those few who did experience and did see and maybe learn something, now they are in a similar position to us as Gen Xers. They're obligated to not have completely wasted their lives, because they can at least tell young people, don't do what we did.
Right, which is what the baby boomers tried to do when the Platypus-affiliated society started.
They said that for a half second, and then they went back to their old shit. They had a half second where they were like, don't make our mistakes, but then they went right back to it.
Right. All right. Well, I hope the coronavirus doesn't get us both. I guess we're on the cusp of being, really susceptible.
Yeah. So here's another depressing thought.
Yeah.
If 99% of the global population is wiped out by the coronavirus, capitalism will still continue, which means the task of socialism will still continue.
That's true. I don't think that's true, actually. If 99% of the world's population was wiped out, that would be basically the same as extinction. I think there's certain levels, if we cut away, that you can't recover from, and we would.
Well, you know that the people who will survive will be disproportionately the technically educated, the people who will actually be needed to continue.
Right. That's true.
So capitalism will continue, and they'll still have to adjudicate the value of labor in a technical productive process.
I think the realistic estimation is something like the worst I've heard is like maybe an eighth of the world's population or something could be knocked out by the coronavirus if things
What's
go really
What's the death
wrong.
Rate so far? It's 1%?
Yeah. 2%.
That's huge. Oh, it's 2%? Yeah, they've been waffling on that. But, you know, I just do the absurd version, which is 99%.
Right.
You know, rather than the 1%. What if it wipes out the 99%? Because it will wipe out the 99%. It won't wipe out the 1%.
Right. It will wipe out 1% of the 99%.
Right.
1% of the 99%.
So, let's hope that that does not happen. And, you know, the struggle continues.
This guy says it's 3.4%.
That's the other. Yeah, I've heard that. That's like an official number. But then they were saying that maybe because there's an underreporting of actual infection, mm-hmm. that it might be close to 1%. But 3.4 is the official. That's right. And that's significant. That's huge. Right.
So I'll tell you what. I want to make a bet. I'm going to bet that Bernie wins Michigan and Washington today. And if he does, I'll give you everything we made in Super Chat. We'll go to the Platypus Affiliated Society or the NGO of your choice.
That would be great. That would be great. And I hope that he does do better than their forecasting. I hope he does do better than their forecasting.
I do.
Because they're kind of forecasting kind of miserable results, which would be bad.
Oh, yeah. This is my last thought. This is something I was trying to get to before. So my real hope once I got involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign and was following it and sort of supporting it was that he would get a plurality, go to the convention, and force them to steal it from him in public.
That wouldn't be stealing, would it?
Well, it wouldn't technically be stealing, like in terms of legality or constitutionality, but it would be overturning the will of the public. And I mean, there certainly would not do that to Biden for him, right?
Right.
It would be. Right. It would certainly be an unfair outcome.
And they have to be careful about that. In other words, they have to beat him in the primaries soundly, because they're concerned that they will have depressed turnout if it seems illegitimate.
Right, but they don't care about that because
they care a little bit. What I'd say is that it's a factor mm-hmm. in their estimation. It's not an overwhelming factor, but it's something for them to consider, because they want the youth vote. They do.
They also know,
by the way, that all the young people in New York and California voting or in Illinois voting doesn't mm-hmm. help them win the overall electoral college.
Sure, but in after Nevada, they were coming out, the pieces were being run in the Atlantic. They were saying, look, maybe the popular vote, maybe the primary system shouldn't be about the will of the majority. Maybe yep. we need experts to come in and yep. determine this stuff.
Yep.
And I thought that if the convention was brokered or was contested convention that went against Sanders, that it could split the Democratic Party, that it could really be historic. But maybe that's where.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, because I don't think the Democratic Party is liable to be split. I think that all of that means is that the Democratic Party would be hurt and in crisis, which it is anyway. Otherwise, right. Bernie wouldn't be a viable candidate of any kind. Right. The Democrats right. are in crisis. They do face a problem. And the question is whether they have to concede to quote unquote socialism to solve that problem. I think that their basic attitude is no, they don't, and that that would create a further problem rather than solving a problem. But if they felt it would solve the problem, they would do it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to put the last little banner on, you know, the outro trailer is the same as the intro one, but thank you very much for spending your time on Election Day with me.
Thanks, Doug. Take yep. care.
The material relations between people become social relations between things.